Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 33 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This episode is with local actor, producer, and writer Kathy Shea, and we talk about Cis Productions' upcoming run of Paper Angels, which is going to be playing in three different locations with two different casts, opening August 7th and running through the 31st. You can get more information at Cis Productions Facebook page, and also by visiting Brown Paper Tickets. I'll have the link for the ticketing info in the episode description. But it's just a wonderful interview. Kathy is so articulate, and I've admired her for a while, and it was just great to sit down for an hour with her and see what her hot topics were and get inside her brain. This episode is sponsored by KLM XYZ Creative Communications. For all of your marketing and graphic design needs, please visit klmxyz.com. All right, everyone, enjoy episode 33 with Kathy Shea. I am pleased to welcome... I sort of have a girl crush on you a little bit because I see you on Facebook doing all this awesome stuff. Kathy Shea is on the podcast. Oh my gosh.
Welcome. You pronounced my last name perfectly.
Oh, good. welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to talk about this production of Paper Angels that's opening on August 7th, and it's two different casts, three different locations. Tell me all about this project.
Yeah, it's actually kind of crazy because it's actually turning out to be our most ambitious project we've ever tried to do. And it all actually started when I, in my day job, I work for the Office of Arts and Culture, and I happened to be doing a tour of Inscape, which is it's the old INS building, the Immigration Right. Naturalization Service Center for the city of Seattle. And really, it was the entrance gateway to the United States for mostly Asian immigrants coming in to Seattle.
Right.
So, it got converted to an art space maybe 5-6 years ago.
Right.
And so it's live workspace, I think. And so all these artists have their studios there. So they kind of did this open house, and you could go in and look, and Satori has their lab space there. So I was touring the building and was thinking, you know, this would be such a great place to do like a site-specific piece. Especially on the second floor, there's this outdoor courtyard, which is, I guess, when it was used as an immigration center, most of the people were actually kept there for a long time. It could have been, you know, maybe a few weeks. It could have been months. And in some cases, I think it was even longer than that.
Wow.
And they were basically kept in sort of dormitory style, what we would basically consider almost prisons, because they were detained there. They weren't allowed to leave,
right.
Period. And the only place they got fresh air was on the second floor in this courtyard space. And I was like, and there was something fascinating about walking through that building, because now it's bustling with arts, but there was a sense of history when you walked down the corridors,
right.
And you could imagine what it used to be and how it was now. And it was just, the feeling was so pervasive with me about just the layers of story and history that could be revealed in the space. And especially when I saw that courtyard, and I was like, what piece could I like stage here as an artist? I've always been fascinated with site-specific work. And then I was like thinking, well, maybe tying with immigration and the fact that it was an Asian immigration center, and the company I run is an Asian American theater company run by women. And so that kind of sparked this idea. And I realized, oh, I know the perfect play for this, rather than creating our own, which is usually what we do. Most of the work we do is actually all new work. But rather than recreating something new, which would have been fascinating, but I remember doing this play in college when I was a student at the University of Washington. And it was just a student production, so it wasn't done professionally. And it was called Paper Angels, and it was written by an Asian American playwright, Jenny Lim. And I realized, well, no one has actually ever done that production here at any theater in town. So other than the people who might have come to see my student production, no one knows this play, and yet it's a classic in the repertoire of Asian American theater. So I thought, why don't we do that play? So I talked to my cis co-creators, and we loved the play, and we talked about different ways of doing it, but it never quite... We kept on focusing on our new work. And so it wasn't until last year we were like, you know, we kept coming back to it. And then as it would happen, the Wing Luke Asian Museum last year launched, or actually the beginning of this year, launched an exhibit about how the place used to be. And they actually put these historical markers throughout the building with archival photos of what the space used to be like. And when they launched, I was like, okay, we have to do our production now. And it would give people a chance to see the Wing Luke's exhibit and also experience the show, which, to be honest, the show is about immigration through Angel Island in San Francisco, but the stories are very, very relevant to all the immigration experiences of Asian immigrants, whether they came in through Seattle or through San Francisco. And not only that, but the fact that it was written by an Asian American playwright supports our mission. It's called CIS because we are an Asian woman run company that focuses on the work of Asian Americans, but ideally through a woman's perspective. And so love that. Plus this last year, as an artist, was doing a project on human trafficking, which is still a huge issue in Seattle. And the play actually intersects with that. So it's about immigration, it's about race, it's about human trafficking, but it's told in this beautifully evocative, lyrical language in the way that Ginny constructs her play. So it's almost like these scene poems that are very theatrical in this one-hour length play. So it kind of, it's just all these different things that really excite me about theater. And so when we decided to start doing it this year, one of the things we thought about was, well, what can we do to really make it resonate more with people now? And so we talked about the intersection of all the relevant themes, and these are things that to explore. But then the other thing that we've really been grappling with this year is CIS Productions, while we're like one of the companies like Satori and a number of companies in town where we don't do set seasons, we focus on when there's a project that we're interested in investigating or doing, we'll do it. And so it might come like every few months, or it might come like a year apart. And the last piece we did was Impenetrable by Mia McCullough, and it dealt with women's issues and the way that women are perceived in the media and how we even view each other and how body image and perception of how people view us in terms of attractiveness and all these different issues in terms of how it shapes our whole self-awareness of ourselves from the time we're young girls. And when we did that piece, it so resonated with audiences, especially young girls from teenagers. We got nominated for this Teen Ticks Award about the impact of art for teens, and then these Asian American female corporation groups. And I mean, it just ran the gamut. And still running into people on the streets where they're like saying, you know, I saw that piece like a year ago and I'm still talking about it with my teenager or my friends. And so we knew we wanted to build on that. And so this doing Paper Angels actually allows us to actually continue on that track of using art in a way to kind of open up awareness about more social justice issues than maybe what we had originally started out as a company focusing on. And also at that time, so women's issues, but also realizing that one of the most powerful things when we did Impenetrable was we had talkbacks after every single performance, and that was as much a part of the experience as seeing the play itself.
Right.
And so deciding that we were going to add that element with this, and it lends itself to that because it's just a one-act play that's an hour long, so it gives us the time to really kind of use the piece as a opening springboard for community dialogue around these issues. And then the other thing that we've really been focused on a lot in this last year is we've been kind of like the go-to company for a number of different companies. Last year, about 49 different casting projects, theater companies, individual directors contacted us in terms of helping them find Asian American actors, right. Referrals for different projects. And we realized that one of the things here in Seattle, a role that we play is about bridging that connection, but also about scouting out talent that is out there, but maybe has not intersected with the Seattle theater scene or film scene at all because of the lack of opportunities. And so in doing that, we go out and actually go see a lot of productions with Asian Americans and realize that there's actually a lot of talent out there. And so this piece, it has 13 roles, and most of them are for Asian Americans. But when we decided to do this piece, we actually, before we even did the casting process, thought, you know, our goal is going to be to try to double cast it in order to actually create even more opportunities for people to kind of learn from each other and build from being in the play and exploring it together. And in a way, you're kind of exploring it with a buddy, right? And also because when, sorry, I'm kind of like zigzagging
it's
a little bit.
It's totally fine.
But when we did Impenetrable, one of the things that came up after we finished the run was we had so many different, we had a large corporation that's a nationally based corporation. We had different college groups approach us about touring the show to them. And our cast was not available. Like we could get like five of this, you know, people, or we could get, you know, certain people to do maybe a scene or two, but we couldn't get the whole cast together because a lot of them went on to do other projects. And so realized that when we went into this production, one of the things we wanted to have space for was double casting it so that it would be potentially available if someone wanted to book it for a one-off show after its main run. So all these pieces started coming together, and we thought, okay, we're going to try to double cast it to create more opportunities. We're also double casting it so that between the double cast, hopefully we'll have enough people who can actually do the show on these one-offs after doing the main run. We decided we wanted to actually kind of seed that by actually doing it in multi-venue so people could see, and also it would create the challenge for our director and designers to envision it as more of a show that was portable.
Right.
And so by having it multi-venues, it forces them to like not like have, you know, a solid set that can't be easily transportable, and to keep the essence of the design as minimalistic as possible. And actually that supports what Jenny wanted for the script. She actually says that in her stage setting for the production. And so all these elements kind of came together, and we were contacting different spaces, but we knew that the heart of it, we wanted to be at Inscape.
Right.
So as it turned out, because we had actually been in negotiations for Satori's lab space for another project that we ended up deciding not to do, their space opened up, but we were also at the same time reaching to the building manager to see about using the courtyard, and then they both came through, so we decided instead of like choosing between one or the other, we decided we'll just do it in both of those spaces at Inscape. But that also then allowed us, which is one of the other reasons why I wanted to do the show, was because the buildings only open when they have like a public open house or when there is a show at Satori. Otherwise, it's just the artists who are working there. And so by having the show run there for two of the weeks that it's in Seattle, it gives people an opportunity actually to see the exhibit, which is free when they come to see the show. And then we decided we also wanted to do it elsewhere. So we contacted all these different venues to see what would be available, but was specifically focused on venues that had a history to the building or the space, so that the minute you entered the space, you could almost feel the presence of the different stories that might have transpired in these spaces long before any of us got here, which actually elevates a lot of the themes and the kind of the essence, the ambiance of the script itself. It talks about the ghosts and the history of people who've gone through Angel Island. And so what we landed on was a space called the Merlino Art Center in Tacoma, where it houses Duke's Bay Productions, which is actually a multicultural theater company.
Excellent.
Run by an Asian American woman and her husband. So we thought that was great. And so Duke's Bay is the resident theater company in that building. And so we'll be using their space for a two-week run in Tacoma before the Seattle run. So yes, it's a multi-venue, double cast show with 24 actors total in two different cities with the potential for more after we finish this run. And it was a huge undertaking and realizing, like, wow, this is kind of crazy. But we just had our first off-book run yesterday, in fact, and I really blown away how the script itself really does transcend time. And then also to also realize it hit us when we were doing the press release for it, that the setting for the play, Jenny set it in 1915. So this being 2015, even though we started talking about this like 5 years ago, it's actually the 100th anniversary of when the events in the play took place.
It just sounds like a powerful convergence of just theater artistry and building community and having a dialogue around thought-provoking issues. And so people are going to want to get tickets. How do they get tickets for this?
So the tickets are set up on brown paper tickets. Okay. And if you just search for Paper Angels, or if you're on Facebook and you search for Paper Angels, it should come up to our event page, which will link you to the ticket page. So either one of those options is probably the most successful way to go. And the tickets are really cheap. Right now, if you actually get tickets before or buy by July 27th, our early bird rate is only $6 to $10 per ticket. So if you're a student, senior, or theater artist, you can get them for $6 if you buy now, or $10 if you're general admission.
If you're a civilian.
And then after July 27th, it just goes up a little bit. And then at the door price is $16 for general admission and $12 for students, seniors, and theater artists. So it's still really accessible.
A really reasonable ticket. And you're getting support from For Culture?
For Culture. Yeah, they're our most ongoing sustainable funder. And I should just mention the only reason why we're not getting support from the City of Seattle Office for Arts and Culture is because I manage the grant funding programs, and one of the decisions I had to make in accepting that job was not to have any conflict of interest whatsoever, and so choosing not to...
So that
no one would perceive the only reason why we're getting grants was because of that, even though they long supported us up until...
I work for Hedgebrook, and I can't apply for the Writers in Residence program. It's one of those...
Yes, but it's so things. That people know that I'm not, like, you know...
That's very graceful and eloquent. That's good. That's a good disclaimer, I think. Why don't we take a little bit, time travel, and talk about how did you come to co-found this production company? Like, what did that spring from for you as an artist?
So, you know, my whole life and career in theater has been, I've been very fortunate. I've been able to work in the arts throughout. And before starting CIS, my trajectory was right out of college. I was working for Northwest Asian American Theater, which is one of the original Asian American theater companies in the country. It has a long history. In fact, we just had a sort of a reunion party. It's been dormant for a number of years, and it's what Theater Off Jackson was, the theater space that they developed and actually did a whole capital campaign to convert from an abandoned, boarded up parking garage into a theater space.
Great space.
Yeah. And so when I was at Northwest Asian American Theater, that was the space where we did all of the works from the time that I started working for them on. And then from that, I went on to do Living Voices, which is a touring company that does social justice works from different points of history in the form of solo shows. And we toured all over the country. And through that, got to kind of experience just a different way of looking at how art can really be used as a innovative way to create awareness about important issues. And then, with CIS Productions, it actually started out because my friends and I, we all happen to be Asian American, we were hanging out talking about relationships, actually, and talking about how, as Asian Americans, specifically people of color, there's very little that you learn about relationships watching the media, or from our own parents, because a lot of our parents happen to be first-generation immigrants. And so they never talked about relationships or dating or even the birds and the bees or any of that stuff with us growing up. And I remember specifically my mom over the phone when I was like maybe 11 years old. She was talking about something about, I've never talked to Kathy about any of that stuff, but I'm sure she'll pick it up from television. But I had no idea what she was talking about. But I knew it was something that she never talked to me about. And it took me a number of years to finally piece together these different random things to finally figure out that she was probably talking about sex and relationships and that I'd pick it up from TV. But the reality was is that watching TV, A, I never saw anyone who looked like me, an Asian American person. B, whenever I did see an Asian American person, they were never having, usually not in any kind of relationship kind of way. It was like that random character or that sidekick or, a nurse character who kind of walked by or a school teacher. But they didn't have relationships with other people. and then C, if you did see them having a relationship, well, actually, did we ever see them having a relationship? It was so rare. But so my friends and I, we were talking about the fact that so never had the talk, never learned about relationships, and then expecting to learn it from television, but never seeing people like us. And then in our real lives, we're grappling with, do we date people of the same race, different race, same ethnicity, different ethnicity? But none of that was ever covered in pop culture. Not in songs, not in television. There was never an Asian American television show, even. All American Girl lasted for like a few episodes, and it wasn't even written by Asian Americans, so it wasn't even real. And so how are we supposed to learn that? So we were talking about, well, maybe we should create something. And then since we were all theater artists, we were like, well, we should create it in the form of theater. So we actually decided, but instead of just doing one show, because if you just do one show, everyone's going to come and they're going to think this is the way all Asian Americans are, because that's how it usually ends up being. You see one Asian American, you automatically think all Asian Americans are like that person.
Right.
And anyone who's ever seen 16 Candles, most Asian American guys do not want to think that all people are perceiving them to be Long Duk Kim, right?
Right.
Or what was his name? That's the name that sticks in my head.
Seems about right.
So the reality was that we thought it needed to be episodic like television was, so that over a number of episodes, people would get to know who Asian Americans were. And that couldn't just be like one storyline. It had to be multiple so that people could see that everyone was different right off the bat. So there were two of us, and we came up with two of us women. The guys decided like, oh, you guys can do that. So my friend and I, we decide to like literally start putting together a strategic plan, a business plan, and who else do we want to get involved? Because I said right off the bat, I think it needs to be more people so we can actually feed off of different ideas, and that they should be of different ages so that we all represent sort of a different aesthetic and generation, as close as we could get to generation. And so we invited two of our other friends. So the four of us actually started brainstorming on the creative side and each created our own characters and storylines. And then we got together to try to meld these storylines together. And then one of the creators, Sarah Nye, she took all of our ideas and actually scripted out the first script. And then we kind of all like evolved that script, and then we did a reading of it, and it was so popular. We did it at what is now Annex, and it was so packed. Like, we didn't even know. We just kind of invited people, and word of mouth spread because we didn't spend any money on PR, and it was so packed that the Seattle Weekly reviewer came late, and this was just a reading, mind you, but we actually had press who wanted to come.
Right.
The Seattle Weekly reviewer came late, and we had to turn them away at the door because we couldn't even get any more standing room only. And then from the audience feedback, we asked them, well, if we decide to actually mount this as a full production, would you come and see it? And it was overwhelmingly positively yes. So then we took all of their input from that stage reading and talk back, and then evolved the script over a number of months into our first production that we did at the Theater of Jackson. And it was a huge success. And from the reading, we were able to seed that first production. And from the first production, we had netted enough money to seed the second one. And so we just kept on doing that.
Right.
And so that became the iconic Sex in Seattle
Right.
Episodic series, which had a huge cult following and actually spun off into a Vancouver, a British Columbia group wanted us to tour up there. But it was, our schedules are such that we couldn't tour up there. So we just said, why don't you just do these scripts up there and we'll help you rewrite them to fit Vancouver. And so that became Sex in Vancouver, which was a huge phenomenal success up there. But all, the whole time when we came up with that original strategic plan, we knew that this would be good, and we want to do this to just try to let people know kind of more about who Asian American women really were in contemporary times, and we weren't immigrants, so we were born here, and we had different views about, you know, each of the characters is very different in terms of how they intersect with relationships. But we knew that we want to use this is just one of the projects, and that there are all these other projects that we wanted to explore, and that this would be a way to build audience to come to some of these other works. And so the reality was the majority of our audience for Sex in Seattle were not theater people. They were people, 65% was Asian, Pacific Islander American, and then we had a lot of multiracial people as well as African Americans, Latino Americans, and Native Americans, because a lot of them saw that at least this is dealing with people of color issues, which resonated so much more with them than anything else they saw in Seattle. The surprise audience out of our 65% Asian American demographic was that we had actually a significant number of people who are first generation immigrants from Asia, from Taiwan, Hong Kong, China, the Philippines, India, and Japan. And when we surveyed them as to why they were coming to see the shows, it was because they felt like they could see people who looked like them, but they could learn really quickly about how to fit into American society, being that they were first-generation immigrants, because when they went to take English language classes, they would learn very formal English and not really colloquial English in terms of how to really, like, interact with people and get dates and and deal with people the way that real people deal with people. But by watching our shows, they were able to do that, but in a way that was much more accessible to them. Ooh. Because it had characters who looked like them on stage. So that was really great. And so from that, it actually spawned a lot of conversations about what kind of shows we wanted to do. Is we always talked with our audience after every performance in the lobby, got their feedback that way. And so we just started doing different theater shows and were able to bridge a lot of these people who had not necessarily gone to theater, American theater, or just theater in general. They were television and film audiences. Lots of the times when the actors would be out, the number one places where we had fans that would come running up to us, oh my gosh, I know who you are, were at Hugh Grant movies. At like Pacific Place. That was a very popular place. We ran into a lot of fans. Out at Green Lake, walking around a lot. We'd run into a lot of fans out there. And the other place that we ran into a lot of fans were in shopping malls. So those were, but that's where the audience that we were attracting were coming from. And so in talking with them in terms of exposing them to theater, we started doing shows that first originally started being ones that were similar, sort of like they're romantic comedies or they were relationship plays that were by Asian Americans, more contemporary based. And so we did Cowboy versus Samurai, which was written by Michael Golomko and was such a huge hit here. And we were able to get artistic directors from a number of different companies to come and see it, that it actually ended up spawning productions in San Diego, Vancouver, British Columbia, and elsewhere, because they actually saw a production and then decided to do it in those other theaters. And then we moved from that to doing different productions that were more interesting for us as theater creators to just explore. But one of the exciting things in all this evolvement of their companies when talking to people was we realized that there were a lot of story ideas that people had, but not many actually scripted plays, that we were talking with a lot of actors who had ideas for scripts, and so we started a writer's group during that time. And in fact, Cern and myself and Kimberly was the other person.
I love her.
Yes. Who we were the ones who actually created the writer's group and got other local Asian American theater artists to be a part of it. None of us had actually really written a lot at the time when we started it. And Kimber was actually able to actually develop a lot of her initial work through that.
Wow.
And that took her into actually thinking, you know, I actually want to pursue playwriting. And then now she's like one of the top not even emerging anymore. She's like one of the top new voices in the playwriting
Absolutely.
Scene in the country. And of course her play, you know, Brownsville will be premiering at the Rep this next season. So, but through that, we've actually been able to cultivate a lot. Maggie Lee is one of our other writers group members now, and she's getting a lot of exposure. We also got commissioned. So different companies locally started commissioning, like Theater Puget Sound commissioned us to develop a short piece for their Arts Crush kind of site-specific work in a hotel. Then we decided to start doing one of the things I always wanted to do with site-specific work. So I created a platform for our writers group where we would actually do, it's a series called Revealed, and they are interactive theatrical tours of Chinatown International District, where you actually, people, audience, actually go on a real tour of Chinatown. And what we have our writers group do is each year we have a different theme, and they have to come up with a very short piece that is spun off of that theme, but they have to research and intersect it in a way that's really tangible and relevant with this international district. And then we cite the pieces based on what the piece is about and how it thematically plays. So when we go on that tour, different aspects of the neighborhood will come to life for the audience. And sometimes they can tell it's actually a piece. Like some of Maggie's pieces are all about, based on Korean folk tales that she kind of modernizes and adds a very quirky, humorous aspect to it. But then other pieces, like we'll take them to a restaurant to sample some food, and we'll actually have an actor play the restaurant owner who will just talk to them and interact with them. But it's all scripted, but the audience doesn't even realize it. And they honestly think that he is the restaurant owner. Or we even had, like, because Sex and Seattle was running when we first started doing reveal tours, where we'll do a scene that was never in Sex and Seattle, but is one where it's actually cited like a gossip bubble tea place, where the characters actually meet there. And the scene was so realistic to the audience that the audience who never seen Sex and Seattle before actually thought, oh my gosh. So, they'd actually came up to me and was like, I'm so sorry you had to run into your ex-boyfriend in this location. And like, oh, that must have been embarrassing for you, because it felt so real to them. And of course, the audience who had seen Sex and Seattle were so excited to actually see a scene that no one else, you know, we get to see. But one of our site-specific, we've had some really interesting encounters when we were at Gossip. For one of the performances, a police officer came running through because I guess some incident had happened down the street, and he thought that the person had run into Gossip. So he came running and looking for them, found one of our actors hiding in the back room because she was about to come out making entrance. Meanwhile, I'm leading the tour trying to make sure that the audience doesn't think the policeman's an actor, and accidentally like do something or say something that would make him pull his gun out. So we've had some incidents like that. Yeah. And like last year, our tour of Revealed was about celebrating women to go along with the theme that we had all year. And so a lot of the pieces were actually about a lot of the Asian American women activists throughout the history of the International District. So we actually had one of the women actually chained to a fence with a sign, and we had some of the security officers in the International District inquire about why she was there and what she was protesting, and encourage her to
move it along.
Yeah, until the rest of the cast came, and then the audience came, and so we've had some interesting intersections like that. But it's been fun. I mean, so we do a wide variety of different projects, but a lot of what we do, how can I say this? We are completely a place and a company that intersects with what we hear from our audience. Like I said, after every performance, we talk with our audience. And so based on what we hear, we take all that information, and then we have a company of different artists who then we brainstorm about what does that inspire in us in terms of the work that we want to create, or plays that we might want to do. And so it's kind of we don't have an artistic director, actually. When we started the company, we actually intentionally did it in a non-hierarchical, non-Western format production company. It's definitely more tribal in nature in terms of everything is done through this consortium of artists who we talk together, we brainstorm ideas, and then we'll come up with different options. And then we have this very egalitarian way in terms of how we vote and decide on what we'll do. And every step of the process is that way. And we mentor a lot of different artists coming through. And the goal of CIS is really ultimately to really empower, especially women and Asian American women, and give them an opportunity to be in decision-making roles, but to also at the same time expose them to a different paradigm for how theater can be operated, so that we all learn from each other and that it's not built on a model that is maybe not as nurturing or as collaborative as women artists tend to maybe be more of.
Well, I think it's wonderful, and I think it's really vital work, because when you hear these cringeworthy things from, and I'm not saying all male artistic directors are like
No,
absolutely
definitely not at all.
But when they say, when you hear things like, we can't find plays by women, or all this stuff, and then you get this convergence of women swelling like the Kilroys and the List.
Right.
And I think it's just now recently that these things are coming to light and just challenging theater artists to shift the paradigm.
Exactly.
So that it works for them.
Exactly.
It works for the audience.
Exactly.
You don't have to keep doing the things the way that they've been done for hundreds of years.
Right? Exactly. And also, you know, we have a lot of different artists who are involved. Some who are still in college, others who have been doing this for a long time, have tons of experience. And what I love about the way that we've kind of structured everything is that there's no, we really strive to really not be hierarchical. I know sometimes we'll have, some directors will come in and that throws them off a little bit, because I think so many people are so dependent on a hierarchical structure that it's a little bit odd when it's much more circular, and that different people cover for each other. And also the reality is that we have women who are mothers in the company, we really do, like, if one person is going to be kind of taking care of the production end of things on this production, but because of her childcare schedule can't cover certain things, we have everyone else filling, and we have a team of people. And I know it does sometimes drive people crazy when it's like, you go to like the artistic director will tell you like you have to do this, this, and this, and then you have other people beneath you that you tell, you assign this, this, and this, and we're much more like a circle that encircles the artists that come in to work with us. And so sometimes it may feel like there's a lot of communication going on, and that there's a much more collaborative process, which sometimes some people don't feel as comfortable with as first.
Sure.
But I know, like, just from the experience of a lot of the different artists who have worked with us, it does seem to work. But in particular, I will say that women and gay men seem to connect with our process more. So that's primarily a lot of the artists that we've ended up working with, is just because it seems to fit their aesthetic more easily.
That's fantastic. So looking forward, what, other than Paper Angels, what's coming up next for you?
Personally or through CIS?
Both.
Okay. Through CIS, our writers group, they are actually in the process of figuring out, and again, we basically give space for the writers group to develop the programs. I've written some grants so that they have some seed money with which to be able to pay either themselves or their artists in doing those projects. But overall, we let them have kind of free rein in terms of whatever they want to do. So they're in the process of figuring out what they want to do for the year. And it's taken the form of different things. Usually it's some sort of showcase model, but some years it's like full-length plays, other years it's like one-acts, other years it's like short plays, or a mishmash of all of them, or so they've not come to a decision about that yet, and that's okay. Again, we're not of a model where, you know, you have to like
there's
do
a
this.
Deadline.
Yeah, they can figure it out in the process they want. And the main goal, though, of the writers group is that whatever way that they decide to showcase their work, it's with the intention of really helping them focus and have a chance to explore their pieces with an audience and with artists, and that they have a space and some basic resources to do that in. So something along those lines will come up. We often every year do a collaborative project with all the other multicultural theaters in town, Hansberry Project, Pratithwani, SA Teatro, and ACT. And that's taken the form of the Multicultural Playwrights Festival called Represent, and we've been doing that annually. This year, though, in complete agreement with all the other companies, every company has been so busy doing more projects than ever that they all decided that maybe we'll take a year off hiatus. So, unfortunately, that won't be coming up, but I did want to point that out because it is one of the unique collaborations in Seattle. And what I love about that project is most years, we actually... because all these companies other than Pathathwani are actually women-run, women of color-run companies, that the plays and the projects and the playwrights that we focus on tend to be majority women of color. And so I want to point that out because it's a huge project that I love that we are a part of, and that Val and I, in brainstorming on ways that we could partner, decided to create Represent. And then so we are looking at what our revealed tour might take the shape of this next year in terms of what the theme might be. So that might be down the works. And we've been reading tons and tons of scripts. And I guess putting a shout out to if there are specifically Asian American or women scripts, ideally both Asian American women written scripts, to let us know about them. We're always excited to read work. We've been getting a lot of scripts from men who are writing scripts about Asian women. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But a lot of them are very really historically based and based in Asia. And if anyone's seen any of our work, that's not our work. So really encouraging stories about Asian Americans and women-centered. And so looking for that. Personally, I've got actually a bunch of different acting projects coming up, so I actually haven't had as much time to focus on some of my writing as I was like. So I've got a bunch of writing projects that are on the back burner right now. But in terms of acting, I am doing one of the roles in Paper Angels. And then after that, I go right into rehearsals for Wet's upcoming production of 99 Ways to Fuck a Swan. It's a
That's
very
a
intriguing
title.
I love the script, though. I love the script. So it's a new work, and I'm really excited to be a part of it. And they have cast it multiculturally, which I'm thrilled about because that's really exciting to me as well, because the script itself does not necessarily per se call for that, which is really exciting because so often the parts I get called in for are if they are specifically written for an Asian American to play, or it's an educational touring show where they want one of every kind, or it's a show that happens to be the holiday cash cow for a company, and then because they want to change it up every year because they do it so often that they'll invite in more actors of color to those auditions. So that tends to be what most people of color in town get called in for. So I'm so excited to be able to be a part of this Wet script.
It's important.
Yeah. And then after that, I go go out of town for a month, so I had to turn down actually a number of projects that I really wanted to do, but I'm going out of town for a month to go to Australia and New Zealand for the first time in December, and then come right back into rehearsals for Amadeus at Seattle Public Theater.
Oh, I just had Brandon on the podcast.
Yeah, and that they're doing it in a very unique way, multicultural cast with, they've actually cast a lot of the roles that were originally intended for men to play with an amazing group of women. And so that's going to be exciting.
What role are you playing in that?
Well, it's an ensemble role.
Okay.
So not one of the lead, but the whole cast is, it's so exciting. Like, yes, I'm really thrilled because it's majority of the cast are people of color or multiracial. And so really thrilled about that. Yeah, so, and I guess one of the things that makes me so excited about these different projects getting to be involved with is because the other work that I do with the Office of Arts and Culture, besides managing all the grant funding programs, is a focus on racial equity.
Right.
And it is the intersection between my day job and the work that I do with CIS and my work that I do as an individual artist, where it's all very holistic in the sense of really doing a lot of workshops over this past year, focusing on specifically how theater companies can be more conscious about how they cast their shows and how they might be able to do it in a much more intentional way that actually elevates or illuminates the scripts that they're choosing in terms of what the playwright's themes are, by using the casting to actually illuminate those themes in a way that's even more relevant to our contemporary audiences. So it doesn't matter if you're doing a production of Emma, like Bookett's doing, I've had fantastic conversations with Carol Roscoe, who's directing it, but that you can actually use casting to actually illuminate the themes of class that are so prevalent in that piece. Or, you know, you can use it in a way in terms of just really making people relook at a piece that may have been done the same way, but just with different casts or different companies, and how just by the way that you cast it, either crossing gender or race, can actually make people like not take the script for granted, but actually make them see it in a new way. So I'm really excited about how that's really becoming more and more prevalent in Seattle in this last year, and that's really exciting to me.
Well, I think about the Language Archive by Julia Cho, and mm-hmm. how reading an article in American Theater about how it wasn't necessarily her intention, but it gets cast different ways often, and how that, you know, sort of just brings out different flavors in the play, and how I think I'm glad that it's coming to people's awareness more and more. And I love one of my favorite moments as an actor is when I read a script for an audition by Courtney Meeker.
Yes.
And she had this
disclaimer.
I don't know. It wouldn't not necessarily a disclaimer, but, you know, the default should not be slim, able-bodied white people.
Right, right.
And I'm like, that was revolutionary for me to read that. Like, I hadn't checked my privilege, you know, like, mm-hmm. and I'm like, yes, let's have more starting with the playwrights, but then also, you know, casting and artistic directors and all that as well.
Yeah. And it's really exciting to see that evolution here. And one of the things I talk about, because so last year I started doing these inclusive casting workshops, because the other thing for my day job, I had put together this convening, partnering with the Seattle Rep, our office, and a number of other community partners around a racially charged casting issue that happened in town, and had this convening, and it just kind of grew. Like, we literally conceived of the idea of doing the convening, and 3 weeks later was the convening. So very short amount of time, but ended up having over 400 people attend this convening at the Rep. But from that gathering, where basically my role as curator for it was really getting as many different perspectives in the room as possible, that so many theater artists and directors and artistic directors started contacting me after that, going, we really want to be more conscious of what we're doing and how that might be fueling whether artists felt included or not included in our theater spaces, but we don't even know where to start. So then I started through my day job programming these different racial equity trainings on white fragility with Robin DiAngelo. I actually commissioned her through our office to develop a training on that term and topic that she actually coined herself based on the fact that in Seattle, and we are such a very liberal, open-minded, progressive city, and yet we actually get in our own way in terms of advancing towards true racial equity. And that, and a lot of it's because we actually are so concerned about making sure that we come across as being politically correct, that we become very defensive if anyone even alludes to the fact that maybe something we did actually put up barriers for true inclusion. And so did workshops on that, brought in Carmen Morgan, who was the consultant who actually worked with Oregon Shakespeare Festival to really transform how they work as a company. And now they are one of the most advanced companies in terms of in theater, really thinking about how you really make your company as inclusive as possible, not only with your audience, but with your artists and the works that you're choosing to do. And then brought in people like Shakti Butler, who's long been a theater artist, multimedia person, who then started using that to really create awareness around social justice. But from those convenings and workshops, getting even more artists and arts leaders going, we want more. Like, now our awareness is blowing our minds in terms of what we realize now that we didn't know what we didn't know. And now that we know that we didn't know, how do we, like, go even deeper to really do something about it? So then all these different people like, you know, Seattle Public Theater and Seattle Shakespeare Company and Book It and just different artists coming to our office going, okay, you know, they needed like all this one-on-one guidance and realizing that I can't do that with everybody. So that we actually started doing from the feedback, they wanted to have cohorts where they could actually brainstorm off of each other because they wanted to do it in the company of other artists. And I think one of the reasons why they felt comfortable coming to me is because not only do I wear that hat of working for the city government, but it's because I'm also an artist. So they knew that they wouldn't have to like try to...
You speak the same language.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's where partnering with the Office for Civil Rights with Diana Falchuk, who is also herself an artist. I'm performing art side and she comes from a visual art side where we were actually able to partner and build on a curriculum that she had developed for nonprofits around racial equity, develop this racial equity learning cohort called Turning Commitment into Action. And we've had one cohort who are well into their cohort year. The second cohort just started last week. And then we have a third cohort that will be launching in October. And so the registrations are still open for that. But it's been phenomenal across every single discipline, from the largest institutions like the Seattle Opera and Seattle Art Museum and Pacific Northwest Ballet, down to really grassroots organizations with smaller staffs, like, you know, people of color run organizations like Den Show, across every single discipline and art service organizations, and where basically they have to commit to 2 to 3 staff and or board people, including someone who has decision-making power in the organization, to basically going through this cohort model for 40 hours of time with each other, plus homework on the side, meetings that they have to do internally in the organization, where each of these organizations are basically doing their own racial equity self-analysis of their organization, and then developing the racial equity plan for how they're going to address their own institutionalized racism at their organization, so that we, across the entire arts and cultural sector, across all these different arts disciplines, can actually work together, be using the same language to really look at structural racism. And the ultimate goal is really so that all of our arts and cultural organizations are truly inclusive of all the people who live and work and visit the city of Seattle, and that the arts are the way to lead that with these phenomenal artists that we have here in this community. But that these arts and cultural organizations sign on because they really want to be doing this work, but just have never felt like there was a place that they could go to have the resources or the tools to even figure out how. And the fact that they're jumping in and doing this, it's been pretty phenomenal. And we're talking like the top leadership, like Pacific Northwest Ballet. It's Peter and Ellen who are the artistic director and managing director. And that's been true of a lot of the different organizations coming into this. Village Theater, it's, you know, Rob Hunt, the executive director, who's coming to the cohort with a board member of his and someone on the education team. You know, so every organization, it's been phenomenal. Like, these are the leaders who are jumping in, and it's exciting. I'm really excited to see where it will go, and the next level. And as I'm sitting in these sessions, listening to people and what they need, that's where my creative hat as an artist comes into play. That melds with my administrative hat as a public servant for the city. Figuring out, like, what's that next step that's going to... And so realizing the next step is we're going to start a cohort for individual teaching artists, because teaching artists are already of the mind of sharing their art form in a creative way to teach, so that we can actually collaborate with different artists who want to be... who are already doing this work, especially artists of color, so that they can actually help... we're kind of like a train-the-trainer model, where they can actually then go into these organizations and help them, so that it's, again, it's not just everyone coming to me or Diana now, but that we actually have a whole cadre of people who are speaking the same language around racial equity and inclusion, but that they're artist-centered, right? Because it's the art that has to be the vehicle through which all this stuff manifests. And then today, literally, as I was walking, you know, here, like coming up with what's that next trajectory from there, and realizing that the next trajectory has to be then connecting, pairing these individual artists going through the cohort with these organizations who have gone through the cohort, so that each organization will have an artist that is centered in their organization, helping them realize the implementation of the racial equity plan, but through the art that's driven by the mission of the organization. So it's not just about all these organizations becoming all of a sudden these social justice entities, but that they're arts and cultural organizations using artists, but that they're using the framework of a racial equity lens with which to do the art that they are so brilliant at doing.
This is an audio medium, but your hands were just like conducting a symphony right there. It was just, it's so obvious that you're so passionate about it and affecting positive change. So right on. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's cool. It's so cool. And I get so excited. I was actually having a conversation on the Metro bus with Alice Gosti, who is a local she likes to call herself, I think, how should she call it, a creator of art experiences. So we were having this conversation, and then as we were having the conversation about feminism and the arts and about the role that women play in the local scene and just kind of breaking boundaries of what art can be and the potential for it, this gentleman across the aisle from us was like, he got so excited. He was like joining in the conversation. And then this other artist who works for Intimon, and then this other person who actually happens to be a student at the University of Washington. So it ended up being like the whole center of the Metro bus ended up being this whole conversation about feminism, arts, crossing gender, crossing race, all this stuff. And then the guy who was the only non-artist, he was like, I don't know what you guys are working on, but all I know is that whoever you guys get involved with this, they are the luckiest people in Seattle, because he could feel the energy that was stemming from all of us in conversation with each other around this. So that was just, it ripples, I think, when people are passionate about what they're doing.
Absolutely. So shifting gears a little bit, I like to ask actors who come on the podcast what is on their bucket list. Do you have roles where it's like, I gotta do it?
You know what's funny was when I was in high school, my bucket list, because as an Asian American person, when I told my high school drama teacher who cast me in the leads of everything, I did Noel Coward and Shakespeare and Neil Simon and all these great roles, that, I mean, race was never an issue, right? When I told her as a senior that I wanted to go into theater, she was like, oh, you know, as a woman and as a person of color, your chances of making it are probably not going to be very realistic. You should think about maybe teaching if you really still want to do theater. And I remember that. So then I thought, okay, if I still want to do theater, I should just think of it as a hobby and major in something else. So I ended up majoring in speech communication instead. And but I remember thinking, I could still do it as a hobby, right? There's a lot of community theater, so I got involved with some community theater. But I actually wrote out some, I saw an audition and they were doing Tea House of the August Moon, written by, I think, John Patrick Shanley. And it was this very dated, you know, it's a very sweet piece. But it's, you know, but I thought about America helping to rebuild Japan after World War II. And so I got cast in the lead in that. And I thought, okay, well, maybe this is my life in theater was just doing these very specific roles for community theater. And so the only place I knew about at that time was, okay, so I'd already done Tea House of the August Moon, and I actually did get to do when I was in high school for Civic Light Opera, Seattle Musical Theater, Flower Drum Song. So I thought the only two roles I had left were playing like Tup Tim in The King and I, and then evolving into some of the older wife roles later on in life. And so that was like, I thought if I did those three, then I would have covered kind of South Pacific. And shortly after I did Tea House of the August Moon, I did get cast in Seattle Musical Theater's production of South Pacific playing Liat. So I was like, I've done it all.
And then
I discovered Northwest Asian American Theater and realized there's all these Asian American plays. But then doing all of them, I realized that, you know, no one's ever going to cast me in these other roles, which is what made me want to do them, was Blanche in A Streetcar Named Desire. Yeah. I've always wanted to do that role. In fact, I auditioned for Linda Hartzell at the South Children's Theater when I was like 17, and I auditioned with a monologue that Blanche does, and she was just like, that's an odd choice, you know, for a 17-year-old girl to do Blanche DuBois. But it was, you know, but as I've evolved as a theater artist, I realized that that question keeps getting asked to me, and I realize that I no longer have a bucket list of theater roles, because my favorite thing is actually I love new work. And so I think my bucket list of what my theater role is are roles that have not been written yet, not even been conceived yet, and that I'm really excited about creating an environment in theater where new playwrights, women playwrights, women of color playwrights have not yet written my ideal roles that would be on my bucket list. And I can't wait for those opportunities to happen and to be able to evolve into what those roles might be.
I can't think of a better note to end this interview on. That's fantastic. Okay, so people are going to want to see Paper Angels, opens August 7th, runs through the 31st. They can get more information at Brown Paper Tickets. And go see this show. Go support dynamic local work.
And see a lot of Asian American artists.
Yes!
Yes.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Katie.